Glenn.
Hi, Cod. How are you?
I'm doing great. I was very honored to talk to Dr. Helen just a couple seconds ago.
Yeah, you got her on the phone. I'm operating without her support down here today, though, so it's a solo operation, and it probably shows in terms of shoddy production values. I don't know.
Well, at least you got her to chip in on the phone help there.
There you go.
Well, I wanted to kick off today with your little back and forth with Robert McChesney that you guys both had at the LA Times.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, kind of a more interesting thing, just to recap for the viewers, McChesney, who is on the board of Free Press, the director of Free Press, his basic point was, contra Glenn, that the government really needs to do a much more of a better job creating a media system where it is rational to do good journalism, in his words. He talks a lot about the postal subsidy that the founders put into the Constitution, and his big point that journalism is dying and the government needs to come in and help us all to make sure journalism continues to do well in the United States. And I think you had a dissenting viewpoint on that.
Yeah, I mean, I two things that sort of surprised me about that back and forth. One was that he and I actually agreed a lot about the nature of the problem. And, you know, I've had these things before where you talk with sort of members of the journalistic establishment and they're sort of in denial and act as if there's not really a problem and so on. And our diagnosis of sort of what's wrong with journalism.
Well, he's not a member of the establishment. He's a professor at University of Illinois, so it's not like he's a...
I count journalism professors as members of the establishment. That's been my experience.
Fair enough.
But at any rate, you know, we really agreed on the problem, the reduction of resources going into reporting, the prevalence of slant and bias, the lack of trust, the sort of crumbling economic foundation for news reporting. And so we're really on the same page with a lot of that. I'm a lot more skeptical that government subsidies are going to do anything to make it better. I'm actually inclined to think not. And I think that's
enlightened policymaking, he called it.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that last.
I said enlightened policymaking, he called it.
Yes, I mean, I thought he was a little short on specifics, and it's really sort of hard for me to even imagine something that's really going to help a lot. And in particular, the journalism's single biggest problem is that people don't want its product as much as it would like them to. And actually, one thing I sort of noted at the end of the piece, which I guess in a way kind of supports his subsidy theory, is that in fact, probably for the last many decades, we've actually been getting more news reporting than people actually want. You know, it's subsidized. TV news is subsidized for the profits by inexpensive daytime programs for women. And as the LA Times itself had reported, audiences for those are drying up, and so there's less subsidy there. Newspaper news reporting is really subsidized by classified ad revenue. With magazines, it's display ads, and all that stuff is getting killed one way or another.
Craigslist, et cetera, yeah.
So, you know, it may be that we're going to wind up getting as much news as people are actually willing to pay for, and it may turn out that's a lot less news than we've been getting for decades.
Well, another big agreement you guys had, which I thought was interesting, something that I think I see a lot on the blog front itself, was you guys both agreed that the way for newspapers to get better from a business standpoint is to invest in, you know, local news coverage themselves. He talks about the Seattle papers and the Seattle paper doing a lot better by putting in more news coverage, and he cites a study from the University of Missouri. And what I see a lot is the better blogs out there starting up all have a more local focus on them. You know, no one's going to break in and be, you know, Matt Iglesias or Andrew Sullivan anymore. They got on the ground floor, and the people that, you know, work their way up and establish blogs these days are focusing on local stuff. And that, when you look at, like, Matt Stoller at MightyD, he wrote a post a couple days ago, weeks ago, on advice for up-and-coming bloggers, and one of his big points was focus on stuff near you that you can go out and report on, whether it's a political rally, a speech, etc., stuff that you can put a video for, can write up, and then contribute to one of the blogs. And that is what I see. The better sites that I pay attention to are those that actually do kind of hard-nosed reporting, as opposed to just, you know, some guy from Santa Monica giving me his new opinion on whatever else is new under the sun.
I mean, absolutely. You know, I mean, you see that in a lot of places. I mean, sometimes you see the sort of sexy stuff. I mean, it's very cool to see people like Michael Totten or Michael Young or Bill Raggio or Bill Ardolino or some of the other bloggers who all seem to be named Mike and Bill, now that I think about it, who, you know, go to Iraq or Afghanistan and embed with the troops and cover this stuff. Most bloggers can't do that. Most newspapers aren't doing that either, and that sort of points to the fact that, you know, hard news reporting is actually the killer app for journalism, which shouldn't be a radical notion. But locally, you know, if you are like a lot of bloggers, kind of obsessive, and you decide you want to focus on the sewer assessment or the school board or pretty much any topic in your community, you can actually put more man hours into covering it than your local newspaper or especially TV stations will. And you can cover it better. And that's a real opportunity to do it. And, you know, you see a lot of it. Now, you also get some pushback, you know, as I guess we'll talk about a bit later. In some sense, local governments are a lot less accustomed to this kind of scrutiny, and they tend to get their back up more when they face it than people at the national level do, which is probably just more evidence that there's a real opportunity there.
You know, there definitely is. I know covering political news, not every time will there be a small blogger, Bill Richardson goes to someplace in Portland or Seattle. But sites like Daily Coast are so large that they're almost like an Associated Press for me. Because I know if I go into the diaries and I type in Richardson or Obama or Edwards, I'm going to find a Daily Coast diarist, you know, in whatever city they're campaigning in that went to an event, that reported on it, etc. Now, you know, of course, this is not an AP report. I'm not going to be reading it thinking it's, you know, the God honest truth. But these people are, you know, they're Daily Coast readers. They're upfront about who they are and what they believe. And you know, that's news enough for me, and that's exactly the type of information that I'm looking for and that my subscribers are interested in.
I think that's exactly right. I think that, you know, you see this more and more. You see so often now whenever anything happens anywhere, whether it's a natural disaster or a political rally or some story, there's usually a blogger in the area who's got some local angle on it that the big media are missing that is interesting and worth looking at. And, you know, there are various ways of sort of aggregating that to make it kind of like a virtual Associated Press. I mean, that's sort of what Pajamas Media is about in some ways. It's kind of what Memorandum and Technorati are about in others. And it is a real opportunity. And, you know, the good news for big media is that if they want to do it, they've still got a huge sort of organizational and resource advantage.
And a platform, too.
Yeah, and a platform for reporting news. The bad news is they don't seem to want to do it that much.
Well, really, they're just too scared.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you a couple of stories. My local newspaper is trying pretty hard, and I have to give them a lot of credit. And they started giving web video cameras to their reporters to take it. So when they interview people for a print story, they can shoot some video and put it up on their website as well. And some of that's worked out really quite well. But I talked to somebody about that who's at a much bigger newspaper in another city, which I guess should remain nameless. And he said, oh, that's a terrific idea. And then, and this is always the tip-off of a dying industry, he said, oh, but we could never do that because our unions wouldn't let reporters do photography. We'd have to have a photographer for that. And I was just,
nice.
You know, that's just, when you hear people say, oh, there's this great thing we could do, and our established interest groups make it impossible, you just know they're in trouble. And I think that's the news industry in a nutshell right now.
Yeah. Speaking of big media, another thing I took away from your LA Times conversation was you guys both were worried about media concentration, kind of in different ends. You remarked how the big media filters today are, you know, Rupert Murdoch, the CEO of Google, CEO of Facebook, etc. And that clicked off in my head problems conservative bloggers have had, complaints about YouTube, and they're booting off certain Michelle Malkin videos and concerns that going into White House 08, there really is no established guidelines for deciding, you know, when videos on YouTube get kicked off and when they do not, and worried about, you know, as popular as YouTube is, what affects a kind of, you know, they're owned by Google, they're headquartered out in the Bay Area, kind of more liberal slant that YouTube has and how that might affect an 08 race.
Yeah, and you've got actually concentration on both ends. You've got the concentration on the platform end, which you see with things like YouTube and MySpace. And it's really a very short list of places that are the big platforms for independent journalism. there's actually also a lot of concentration going on the advertising end. And we had done a podcast interview with David Verkland, who's a big ad buyer and has a book out on the advertising business recently. And he agrees, you know, you're really looking at having three or four platform providers and three or four big advertising buyers
What's the worry there, then, of having, Google buying most of the ads?
Well, you know, it's just that if Google decides they don't like you, you're really shut out of a big piece of the market. And, in fact, you know, Google is such a big player on both sides now. You know, they can kick you off YouTube and they can shut down your ads. That makes them pretty potent. And they haven't really – YouTube's problem has not been evil. It has been cowardice. I mean, they basically just take stuff down if too many people complain, and they don't look very hard at what they're complaining about. And they've been spoofed a number of times with bogus claims of copyright infringement.
So, right, right.
So you know, they've basically just been wet noodles. They haven't been evil censors trying to throttle the debate back. But they're certainly in a position where they could, and that's got to be troubling.
And as a, you know, admitted libertarian, what would you look for as solutions there?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess if it becomes a problem, there's a decent chance the market will take care of it. For example, I don't actually use YouTube very much because I favor one of their competitors called Motionbox, just because I think it does better video. And, you know, if Google kicked me off YouTube, I could put my video back up on Motionbox pretty fast. Or if Motionbox kicked me off, I could put it up on YouTube. And there are these commercial hosting services as well that are presumably less willing to bow to pressure since you're paying them. So, you know, it's not a huge problem, but I suspect Google's going to attract some antitrust scrutiny. And that's something about which I'm ambivalent, but there's nothing necessarily anti-libertarian about being concerned about antitrust violations. So we'll
fair enough. I want to move on to the John Chait's Netroots article, which is getting tons of talk on Blogging Heads as well as throughout DC. You read the piece a while ago?
Yeah, back when it first came out a few weeks ago.
I just wanted to kind of ask you, Chait's kind of thesis is that there has long been a conservative media or conservative movement and a media establishment to go with it, with National Review, the Human Events, etc., talk radio, and that he hasn't really talked about conservative bloggers much, but that they are just a cog in that right-wing noise machine, and that the great thing about the Netroots, because his article is mostly laudatory, but he does have some worry, is that they are a counterbalance to that, and that they're essentially a democratic noise machine to balance out the right-wing noise machine. So I was just curious whether what you feel about that picture and where you, Glenn Reynolds, Instapundit, you know, highly trafficked right-leaning blogger, whether or not you feel you fit in with the right-wing noise machine.
Yeah, well, let's start with the first. I mean, I think the conservative response to that would be that we already have a left-wing noise machine, and it's called the media. And that, you know, when you're talking Dan Rather or Katie Couric or
The New York Times, Frank Rich,
Rosie O'Donnell, for that matter, that, you know, all of those people command a bigger audience than almost any right-leaning organization. In fact, one of the things that the so-called right-wing noise machine actually does is forces the left-leaning major media to pay attention to issues they'd rather ignore. So I think that would be one response. But I think he's right. I mean, I think the Democrats came out of the 2004 election feeling that they needed something on this side, that things that big media had tried to do hadn't worked out very well. For example, Dan Rather's National Guard story, which was blown up by bloggers mostly on the right, and that they needed to be ready to occupy that space and contest it by 2008. And a lot of money went into that and a lot of interest and a lot of effort. And, you know, they had some success in 2006, not so much with Ned Lamont, which took up a lot of energy, but in some other areas, I think you could argue that Netroots support helped Jim Webb win his seat in the Senate, which was pivotal, though I think some people might say the Washington Post support was probably more important. And the other side of it was George Allen ran an absolutely miserable, pathetic campaign, which the Netroots can't be blamed for.
Well, there's also the Mark Foley story, which was...
Yeah, that was a tipper, too. And, you know, it's like, I think Rich Lowry at National Review actually said about the Mark Foley story, it wouldn't have made such a difference except that the Republicans had let themselves get in such a perilous position that they just couldn't take any more bad news, and then they got some.
Yeah, it was just from a, you know, from a bad rain to a, you know, gale force wind.
And that is a good example of a story that was originally floated sort of, you know, semi-covertly through the blogs and allowed to bubble up into the big media, which I think is something we'll see a lot more of in 2008.
Yeah, you know, Lane Hudson is now a regular blogger at the Huffington Post now. I remember first seeing his picture over there and was like, oh, I wonder where he would finally resurface.
So, yeah, so, you know, I mean, and we'll see, I think, a lot more of that. As for the second part, you know, where I fit in, I don't know. I mean, first of all, I'm not sure that the so-called right-leaning blogosphere fits within the notion of a disciplined noise machine. I mean, it's currently mostly savaging the GOP establishment for its immigration bill.
Right now, yeah.
And indeed threatening basically to give the presidency to the Democrats if it's on that ground.
But at the same time, though, I remember, you know, with John Kerry and his the Swiftboat Veterans and his Christmas Eve in Cambodia, you were one of the first ones to be photographing his testimony from libraries in Tennessee, I think, and getting that on the web, showing he was contradicting himself.
Yeah, that was actually really funny because, you know, that quote had already been on a lot of blogs, but nobody quite trusted it because it was just something, you know, that people typed into their blog or cut and pasted off Nexus, and there were a lot of people challenging its authenticity. So all I did was I went into the law library one Saturday with my digital camera and looked it up in the Congressional Record and photographed the pages and put the page on my blog, and there was, you know, this conveyed no new information, really, but it seemed like it had a really big effect somehow. It just made it seem much more real.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, when they see, you know, they don't trust pixels as much as they do black and white, and so your pictures of, like, here's the Congressional Record, here's what he said, and it's different from what he's saying now. It was, you know, especially when at the time everyone was saying that everything the Swiftboat people were saying were lies, and to have it, you know, backed up by a photo that people could see and say,
yeah,
oh, my God.
That was a pretty major climb down for Kerry, absolutely, and it was a big deal. But anyway, you know, to sort of follow my point, and this is, I think, also actually somewhat true of the Netroots on the left, too, though they're gradually becoming more domesticated. The blogosphere is, to some degree, its own independent source of power, and the establishment doesn't always like it because they want different things. I mean, it's bipartisan. You know, the people in the Sunlight Foundation are very involved, and they're generally pretty left-leaning. But the Porkbusters movement is something that the Republican establishment absolutely hates. Ramesh Panuro has been savaging it in the National Review this week. Trent Lott said he was sick and tired of Porkbusters and so on. So I don't know. I think, though, the left and right blogosphere sort of started from different places.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the right blogosphere mostly focuses on punditry. And there's, in fact, been sort of a discussion going on within some of the right bloggers on whether they should become more activist like Coase and the other lefty bloggers. But the right blogosphere, to the extent it was organized by any principle, I think was organized by people who felt like the mainstream media leaned left and there was a need for offsetting reporting and punditry on the right. And so you've got a right blogosphere that's a sort of mostly a pundit sphere.
And that feeling was there long before the internet.
Right.
I mean, that feeling helped spur, you know, talk radio and,
right,
you know, Fox even.
So you wind up with you know, right-leaning opinion bloggers and, you know, a fair number of, I mean, I think it's exclusively bloggers on the right who have gone to Afghanistan or Iraq and said, I'm going to report what it's really like because I don't trust what the big media are doing. So I think, you know, that's been a big, so in the reporting and journalism, too, that's been more on the right. On the other hand, the political machine, the effort to sort of build something that, you know, generates grassroots efforts and produces campaign contributions and sort of directly affects the actual mechanisms of politics, not so much on the right. And I think there's some move to change that, some discussion of whether it should happen.
Well, I think that difference was mainly due with the fact that, for the large part, conservatives were happy with the effectiveness / tactics of their party, whereas the Democrats were, you know, looking at the Tom Daschles of the world saying, you know, can anyone play this game? We need to go in there and, you know, management needs to be fired and we need some new people running the show.
Yeah, and that sentiment's now showing up on the right, and I think in both cases it's justified. But at any rate, the left side felt like their people were doing a bad job of grassroots and political work and wanted to do more of that. The right side felt like the deficiency for them was sort of in the information sphere and went that way. And so you got two somewhat different approaches. As for where I fit in, I don't know. I mean, I you know, I have been a card-carrying member of two parties, the Democratic Party and the Libertarian Party, and I voted for Clinton in 92.
So you're registered now independent and
were
well,
there's before? There's no registration in Tennessee, so okay. I'm not registered anything. You have to join the party and pay them dues to count as a member of a party in Tennessee. We don't do that registration.
Make you pay dues?
You have to like join. When I belonged to the Democratic Party, it wasn't much, but I paid them something, and I got Democratic Leadership News in the mail, and I had a little card. And then in 96, I had voted for Clinton in 92, but I was kind of unhappy with the 94 and 96 crime bills. I voted Libertarian in 96 and 2000. I actually joined the Libertarian Party and had a little card for a while. Then in 2004, I was...
The Libertarians didn't make you pay dues, did they?
Oh, yeah, they make you pay dues. nothing for free.
There you go.
You know, this is Libertarian.
No such thing as a free lunch.
I don't know how well I fit that mold myself. The thing that makes people think of me as right-leaning is basically the war. I'm against gun control mostly, but so are lots of Democrats. I am pro-choice, so, you know, as many Democrats, I guess, are not. I don't know where I fit on the spectrum otherwise, but it's a single-issue litmus test now. Left-right is the war. And so that's what has people put me on the right.
So I guess it's a good point to kind of get into the rise of Instapundit. I kind of wanted to walk the viewers view, you know, from where you started and how your traffic grew and what is the enterprise that is Instapundit today. So how did you get your start?
It was the way I do most things, kind of by accident. I teach internet law, and I've done a lot of different sort of things on the web, which I do partly because the internet's a big playground for guys like me, and partly because
what is internet law? I actually went to law school, and one of my professors always jokes, you know, there's no law of the internet. It's like saying there's a law of the horse.
Well, that's right. Internet law is a little bit like, I don't know, admiralty or, you know, sports law or entertainment law or one of those other subjects that... I call them horizontal subjects. They revolve around an industry and take in a lot of stuff, as opposed to being sort of a vertical subject that's all one idea.
Like contracts or tortures.
Right. But internet law, if you want to know the truth, it boils down, 90% of internet law is jurisdiction. I try to keep my hand in and sort of stay up on what's going on. So I had been running, I have a band, and I'd had some websites for it, and I was running a website called RaveRights.com, which was...
What year are we talking about here?
This is like 2001.
Okay.
And this was a website that promoted the rights of rave promoters and attendees against what was going on at the time, which was the DEA's effort to shut them down.
Wow. So you got your start, first of all, protecting raves, but second of all, as an anti-drug warrior.
I've always opposed the drug war. RaveRights.com, I don't know how much it amounted to, but I tried, and it got sort of subsumed. Moby gave a lot of money to form the Electronic Music Defense Foundation, and so I redirected to them and shut it down, and actually did some legal work with them at the ACLU on the New Orleans rave case. They took the position that a rave is a mechanism for delivering drugs. That was the DEA's approach.
So right.
If you had a rave, you were basically...
You were distributing.
Basically, yeah. So I worked on that. But around that time, the summer of 2001, I had... There was a brief, short-lived blog called Monkey Fishing, which was making fun of Slate. And I ran across it probably via Slate or somewhere. But what was really exciting was not the blog, which didn't last long, but the fact that I discovered the Blogger platform that way.
Oh, okay. And so then you ran into some nice software.
Yeah, so I started... That made it look much easier. I'd been using Dreamweaver for my web stuff, which I got to tell you was no fun. So I started using Blogger, and I was like, wow, this is great. And started my blog in August of 2001. And I thought, you know, I got some friends who are professors and some journalists. I can probably get me a couple hundred high-quality readers, and that'd be kind of cool. And
so
we'll see how it works.
At that point when you kicked off in August 2001, were you Instapundit yet?
Yeah, I had been posting in the fray over at Slate, and that was actually not my main pseudonym over there, because everybody posted with handles there.
Right, right.
I mostly posted as AG Android, which is actually my techno band pseudonym. But I did use Instapundit sometimes. I kind of liked that. So
you had more than one handle over at the fray.
Yeah. which was common at the time. I think they went to a registration system later that made that a lot harder, but I would often change my handle to suit the topic. I commented on art as Adolph William Bouguereau, which not many people got.
So I'm sure some appreciated the effort.
I hope so. Anyway, you know, so I started the blog with the Instapundit name, and didn't, you know, like I said, expected a couple hundred readers. I thought that was pretty cool. And actually, it really took off pretty fast. By the end of August, I had about 600 page views a day, and I thought that was really a lot. And I remember talking to one of my friends on the faculty and telling him that. He was like, wow, 600 people.
Do you have any idea who they were at first?
Well, you know, it was funny. I got a couple of links early on from Best of the Web and from Virginia Postrel, and I think that got me some pretty good
ones. Okay, so WSJ, or Wall Street Journal, is Best of the Web, and Postrel, she was with Reason at the time,
yeah,
right?
She was still the editor of Reason
okay.
then. Yeah.
So you were getting Reason and Wall Street Journal.
And so, like, well, Michael Barone readers. Was one of my early readers, because I remember okay. getting an email from Michael Barone, and he, you know, that, I thought that was really cool. And then I'm trying to think who the New York Times reporter was. I want to say Felicity Berenger, but that may be wrong. But I had some question about a New York Times story and got an email from whoever it was within an hour or two saying, oh, no, you're, I can see how you misunderstood that, but here's what this really means. And so I thought that was sort of cool.
Hmm.
And that was all, you know, pre-September 11th. And then the big sort of kickoff was September 11th. I had like 1,000 page views the day before, I think, or 1,100. And then the next day, was September 11th, and I started off with my usual stuff. I had a post making fun of the drug war, I think, and some other stuff. And I was on my way to work, and the attacks happened. And I got there, and I put up a post pretty quickly of sort of what I thought it meant, which actually held up, I think still holds up pretty well.
And what was your first take?
I'd rather actually refer people to it, and we'll put the link up with Blogging Heads.
We can do that.
Summarize it, and I also got an email from a domestic terrorism list I was on, showing that the Posse Comitatus was taking sort of not quite taking credit, but that their website had almost immediately updated to cheer the event. And say that it was a great thing, and that it was going to teach those Zionists in New York and stuff.
You lost me. Who
said this? Posse Comitatus is a sort of wacky, right-wing, white nationalist kind of group.
Okay.
And that, you know, nobody knew much then. It wasn't implausible. And so I put up a post about that, and that got picked up in Best of the Web that day.
Okay.
So that got a lot more attention. And, you know, the other thing was a lot of people were sort of stunned. I know Mickey Kaus didn't post for a couple of days. I actually was worried about him and wrote him saying, are you okay? You weren't on one of the planes, were you? And he responded eventually saying, no, I'm just too stunned to write anything. And that, for whatever reason, that didn't happen to me. So I think, you know.
So while everyone was just hungry for some type of information analysis, you kind of stepped into the void.
Yeah, I mean, I had stuff there, and you know, I was fast. Rate of fire has always been my strong point.
Putting the instant upon it, huh?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, you know, that's what I did, and it just sort of grew from there. And traffic has, I mean, it goes up and down to some degree with the seasons of the year and the news cycle and such. But there's kind of a gradual, generally upward trend, and I think the blogosphere is growing faster than my traffic is now, which is fine. This week I was
Are you affected at all by the election cycles? Do you have spikes with the 06 and 08 stuff going on?
Yeah, but not as much as you'd think. I mean, it was sort of interesting. My biggest traffic month in 2004 was not November or even October. It was actually September. And September was, of course, when the Dan Rather Gate story broke. Because I, you know, I think that sort of
but shows still election related there.
It's election related, but I think it kind of shows that Instapundit's more of a media criticism blog than it really is a political blog per se, if that makes any sense.
Well, no, I mean it does. And H.R.S. claims to be the same. He claims to be more of a media critic than a political activist. So
yeah. So anyway, you know, I think that there's that. But it sort of drops off after the election, but it comes back. And my traffic now is actually higher than my traffic was, you know, in the fall before the election. So, I'm not sure. I get tired of blogging about politics all the time, and I had planned when I started the blog to blog mostly about tech stuff and quirky pop culture stuff and issues I was interested in, like, you know, the sort of anti-drug war stuff and things like that. And because of superseding events, I've done a lot more political and war blogging than I planned to, and I do kind of get tired of that from time to time.
Well, I hate to rain on your parade then, but I do work for the hotline, and we do politics, and that's about it. So I got to ask about White House 08. Do you have any current GOP favorites? What case would you love to hear from any one of them that would get a Glenn Reynolds vote?
It's really too early to say. I can sort of tell you who I like.
Who you like?
Of the field that's actually in the race right now.
That's declared.
I like Rudy Giuliani the best. And I say that notwithstanding, I mean, I have some real reservations. He's a bit nanny state-ish, to put it mildly. I mean, he's fortunate that he has Mike Bloomberg to come after him to make him look like a libertarian by comparison. But, you know, he's not good on the Second Amendment issues that I care about. On the other hand, you know, the stuff that a lot of Republicans and actually a lot of Democrats are sort of bashing him for, which is his pro-stance, social issues stuff, that's all fine with me. I agree with that, so that's cool. You know, the thing I like about him is that unlike a lot of the field, he's got a decent amount of executive experience, and I think that's probably a good thing. And, you know, so I guess I would put him as my favorite. John McCain, I mean, we did a podcast interview with him. He was very engaging and everything. I like it that he's been strong on the war. I think, though, that he is, I mean, I'm just not sure that he is the guy who could be an executive leader and get people to go along with it. He doesn't seem like a coalition builder. And his experience has not mostly been executive-type stuff. He's got a short fuse. Now, I've heard some people say they like it that McCain has a short fuse. They figure he's just crazy enough to bomb somebody and that will at least scare people. Sort of, remember the crazy Nixon strategy? It worked for him, you know? So I don't know. I don't like his campaign finance reform position at all. I'm not sure what I think about the immigration stuff.
What about your native son out there in Tennessee?
Fred Thompson?
Yes.
Well, he's not a declared candidate.
No, but he's inching towards that direction.
On issue stuff, I mean, Fred, you know, as you guys actually had in the National Journal, I think, a wrap-up of his votes when he was a senator and showed that he was not especially conservative. He tended to be around number 20, I think, on conservatism.
Right.
In the Senate.
Shared a lot of the same concerns and focuses of John McCain.
Yeah.
You know, anti-corruption, China, he was on board with him as far as campaign finance.
Yeah, which I don't like either. I mean, issue-wise, he's closer to me than McCain, I guess. You know, he's, and very much like the state of Tennessee, he's sort of a moderate, sort of quasi-libertarian, right-leaning guy, not a big social con or anything. Very few actors are. I'll tell you what I like about him, and this has actually been something that's come out during his shadow campaign, is that he really seems to get the new media stuff.
Yeah, he loves posting in Red State, and he had an open letter at Pajamas Media this past Thursday or Friday, talking about how wonderful the blogosphere was, how important it was to democracy.
And he did that wonderful rapid response video to Michael Moore.
Yeah, we'll have to for any blogging viewers that haven't seen it yet, I don't know how they haven't, but it was truly masterful.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, it's not only that execution, but the whole strategy is just really smart. I mean, I've been saying on my blog for a while that it was stupid for people to start running so early. That when you start running early, you just give yourself more time to make mistakes. You give voters time to get sick of you before it's even time for the election. And you wear yourself out. I mean, the fact is, you know, if one of these candidates who's running for president gets elected, they're going to take office already exhausted from a two-year-long campaign. And I think exhaustion...
Well, I'll dissent a little bit there. I mean, all candidates come in with different advantages and strategies. And, you know, for someone like Romney running kind of more of an establishment campaign, you need to be out there early, hitting all the early benchmarks. You know, McCain also filling that role. I mean, he's been running since 1999, really. He's already in it all the time. I will agree with you on, like, you know, Rudy and the rest of them. I just think that, you know, while people can say, you know, yeah, they don't need to get in so early, you know, four different candidates are going to be running different types of campaigns, I think you do sometimes have to be out there early, getting all the right endorsements.
I'm not sure.
All the right people nailed down in the right states.
I'm not sure. I mean, I think, for example, Obama's made a number of minor but telling gaffes, and he's even said he's tired, and I think, you know, I think he is.
He said he's tired more than once.
I think it's a growing theme.
Yeah,
you know, it's awfully early to be that tired, and I think that, you know, I just think it's, and actually his initial sort of surge in the polls has sort of leveled off, because I think he's not, you know, part of his appeal is he's fresh and new, and that you're only fresh and new for so long, so it's a mistake to get into work.
You know, I'm also not a big fan of the tired, you know, excuse, because, look, ideally, you're going to want to be president for 8 years, and campaigning's exhausting, but being president's even worse. So, you know, looking at 8 years ahead, you know, what's one extra year of campaigning?
Yeah, and, you know, I have to say, one place where I sort of changed my mind a little bit on this is I've generally sort of favored this notion that it's better to have people who don't really have a burning desire to be president. As president, but I'm actually watching Bush, and I'm not sure about that. And I'll say McCain, you know, well,
you don't think Bush wants to be president anymore?
No, and in fact, back in when my blog was very new, in the first month before September 11th, you know, Mickey Kouse had a thing where he said Bush doesn't look like he's having much fun being president, and I put up a post, you know, sort of jokingly saying, well, you know, who, no sane person really would enjoy being president that much, and my suggested slogan for, you know, the next election was, you know, vote so-and-so, just crazy enough to want to be your president. But I think you almost need this kind of core of, I don't know what the right word is, narcissism or whatever, to survive in the job. And, you know, the thing that a lot of people found...
I think the polite word for it that I use is skill set. You have to have the right, you know, desire and skills to go out there and press the flesh, you know, be a good politician, recognize what people's needs are, etc.
Yeah, and like it. I mean, you have to be energized.
You have to like it. That's the kicker at the end. You have to like it.
Bill Clinton, one unattractive side of Bill Clinton to a lot of people was, you know, what I think George Will described as his vulgar pleasure in office. And there was some truth to that. But the thing for Clinton was he was energized by this. He could go out and press the flesh and do all this crap that would leave me just a mass of quivering jelly within a couple of days, and he would have more energy at the end of it than when he started.
Well,
I think Bush's problem, speaking of tired, is, I mean, I think the truth is he ran down in 2005. I think he's been exhausted mentally, physically, emotionally, and I think it's hurt his administration and it's hurt the country. So somebody who, you know, has that burning desire in him, that maybe that's better than I used to think.
Well, you were talking about Clinton earlier, and you mentioned you voted for him in 92. Is there any possible way a Democrat could talk Instapundit into voting for them in 08?
Well, I want somebody who I felt was strong on national security, and I've been actually, I've been accused of being a Hillary Clinton booster on my blog by people.
Really? What for?
Because I have pointed out that she's been really pretty good on the war. I mean, she's sort of genuflecting to the netroots some now, because she has to, but not all that much. Now, this is a place where my wife disagrees with me strongly, but my feeling is that, you know, she's been pretty good on that. And while people have criticized Hillary Clinton for a lot of things, lack of backbone and unwillingness to be tough with people who challenge her authority are not the things that people usually criticize Hillary Clinton for.
Yeah, you know, the say she's, you know, ice cold or whatever.
That's
definitely not a compliment, but that's definitely... On the other hand, it definitely shows, you know, strength, etc.
Yeah, I have sort of a running gag on the blog. I refer to this science fiction novel by John Birmingham that's set in the year 2021, one of the things in it is the aircraft carrier, the USS Hillary Clinton, which is named after the most uncompromising wartime president in United States history. And, you know, that's sort of good for a gag, but the reason why he put that in the book and the reason why people pick up on it is that she's sort of plausible in that role.
Before Andrew Sullivan fell in love with Barack Obama, he was, you know, always hoping that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But that's sort of the sort of thing I'm looking for. I mean, domestic policy, you know, there's a few. I have to say, Obama has really kind of disappointed me on... I knew he was against the war,
did you read his foreign policy speech or address at all?
Yeah, and that was, I thought, sort of a weird mixture of tough and not so tough.
Because he wanted you know, a larger army.
Right.
And he said, you know, he would leave a force in Iraq, which was a big no-no on as far
yeah,
as the Democratic Front. Right, right. Well, they ended up giving him largely a pass for other reasons. You know, I mean, he did stress other, you know, non-terrorism threats, global warming, diseases, AIDS, etc. But, you know, there also was a very strong military bent to it that turned a lot of people in the Netroots off.
Yeah, I guess I'll have to see how much I believe he really means that. You know, and luckily we have lots of time. That's a good advantage side of having people come in so early.
All of a sudden you're in favor of the time.
Well, no, it's you know, everything has its plus and minuses.
There you go.
What I will say about his domestic stuff is, I mean, I watched his speech about the automakers, and leaving aside the stuff about the 45 miles per gallon that Japanese cars get,
right,
may not have been a gaffe, I just thought it sounded kind of tired. And, you know, as I said on my blog, I said, look, if you really want better mileage, put a $5 a gallon tax on gas that works its way in 50 cents a year over 10 years. You'll get better mileage in cars. If you're not willing to do that, if you're willing to yell at automakers for giving people what they want instead of what now we think they should have, you know, whose fault is that? I mean, in 1999, when gas was $1 a gallon or less, I bought a VW Passat wagon that got good mileage, and everybody was telling me, why are you doing that? Gas is so cheap. And, you know, I tried driving a couple of big sport utes that got terrible mileage, and I just didn't like them. But, you know, people bought those things because they could and because they wanted them. And gas prices get higher, and people start to get more interested in hybrids. But if you want people to buy cars that get better mileage, don't proceed by indirection to try to fool the voters into thinking it's not costing them anything.
So could you vote for a pro-gas tax, strong on defense, Hillary Clinton over a campaign finance reform, John McCain? Theoretically.
Theoretically, I mean, it's plausible. You know, I mean, McCain's good on the war, and I guess, you know, it would take a lot to convince me that Hillary Clinton was as strong on the war as McCain. I tell you what, though, if Bill Richardson were better on the war, I would jump on him, and I'm actually giving him a little bit of a pass on the stuff he's saying for the war, even though the Netroots like it, because, and this goes actually to all the candidates in a way, I guess, you know, the fact is, people can say whatever they want to say about what's going on with the war now. When they're president, it'll be 2 years from now, basically, before they'll have a chance to have any really dramatic effect on what's going on.
And yeah, it's going to look completely different.
They'll do what seems like the thing to do then, regardless of what they say now, and that's true for the Hawks and the Dubs. So I'm sort of more interested in looking at their overall philosophy. And I have liked Richardson on a lot of other issues, and he's good on the Second Amendment, too. We'll have to see.
You know, he came out with his energy plan. It's much more Obama-like. It's much more on the CAFE standards, et cetera. And
he did not come out with
a carbon tax. I mean, a carbon tax for a gas tax.
That's a disappointment. I hadn't seen that.
He was at the New America Foundation Thursday or Friday.
This is for a guy who drives 90 miles an hour, you know, as he does. Although he drives 90 miles an hour in a hybrid, unlike John Corzine. So I guess that's something.
There you go.
I don't know. I let people show me stuff. I mean, it was funny. I was out for breakfast with my daughter this morning, and the people in the booth behind us were talking about the elections, and they were pretty well-dressed. They looked to be pretty well-off. And one of them said they'd like to have at least one election where they could vote for somebody instead of just picking the least bad alternative. And another guy saying he didn't care who it was, except that if it was Hillary Clinton, he was going to cash out his retirement and leave the country and back and forth. So I guess in a way, you know, I'm criticizing people for starting the campaign too early, but there are people who are interested.
Yeah, they are. They're called hotline subscribers.
And they pay a bundle to prove how much they are, because I know what you guys charge.
It's true. It's not a small amount.
Not a mass market publication.
No. Although the Blogometer is the only part of the hotline that is available free to the public.
Explain something to me. The hotline blog...
You mean, oh yeah, there's OnCall, which is the hotline blog.
Right.
And that's more of a newsy analysis type site. So we break news there, and then we also kind of, we call it the evolving wisdom of the hotline staff.
I just wish you had individual item links on the blogometer. It always bothers me to have to link to the whole day every time I link to anything in blogometer.
Yeah, actually, when I first took over, I did individually link to each story, but no one ever linked to my individual stories. They were just linked to the blogometer, so I stopped taking the time. But, you know, if InstaPundit says he'd linked to my individual stories, maybe I'll reconsider that
whole
process.
Well, if you had a decent platform, you wouldn't even have to do any of that. It would just do it for you.
But
the bigger the media outfit, the worse the internet platform. That's been my experience.
Well, you know, we've been promised a new media platform here at National Journal Hotline since I started and even before my time. So,
type. It's easy. It's cheap. It works.
So we'll eventually get there. Well, we're at the 45-minute mark, so I think we'll go ahead and check off for today, Glenn.
Well, it's been fun.
It's been great, and I'll hopefully see you around the next time you're in town.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, talk to you later.
Bye.